Scott Report. Welcome to the Coon Brown Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, and I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. This week, we will be talking about the call to life of the Skid Row community with Leilani Sasse, Lee Shaw, Andrea Ross, and my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Speaking of the Skid Row community, and before we get into an in-depth discussion of the call to life of the Skid Row community, I would like to play a short portion from Surviving the Nickel, a play about the Skid Row community that was performed Sunday, September the 30, 2012, at the Vortex, and will be performed this Sunday, October the 14, 2012, at the Exchange located at 114 West 5th Street at 4 o'clock. So it's about 2 minutes and 19 seconds. The play Surviving the Nickel that would be performed this Sunday, October the 14, 2012, at the Exchange at 4 o'clock. And the Exchange is located at 114 West 5th Street, downtown Los Angeles. Now, to help us discuss the cultural life of the Skid Row community, I'm delighted to have with us in the studio Leilani Sasse. Andrea Ross, Lee Shaw, and my co-host, Earlene Anthony. So welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you.
We're going to start off with Leilani. Can you tell us a little about yourself and how did you first come in contact with the Skid Row community?
Oh, okay, a little bit about myself. Okay, I'm a multicultural, diverse woman who does not have a one-track mind. I multitask, too. I'm mother three, married, and I consider myself a phenomenal entertainer and woman, mm-hmm. and a great woman of God. How did I first get down here on Skid Row? I think what brought me down here, I came here from Hawaii, a divorce and a mental challenge I was facing. a nervous breakdown. I think it was my third one at the time. I didn't know I was having a nervous breakdown. So that's what brought me down here. I followed a gentleman down here whom I thought was a friend of mine, and turned out to be, I wrote a song about it, but turned out to be, an experience. So.
What were your first impressions about the area, about Skid Row, when you came in contact with it?
I wrote a monologue about my first impressions of Skid Row. When I was here in a taxi, and I was here on Main and Fifth Street, what they call the nickel. And when I looked beyond the taxi, it was at nighttime, so the moon was very full and it looked very large. But beyond Los Angeles Street, it looked like the abyss, like a bottomless pit. And I actually thought I was in a bad dream. When I first came down here at Skid Row, there was debris being thrown out of to two hotels. I was on Fifth, so I was between what they call the Hotel Roslyn and the Frontier. And there was debris coming out of the windows, pails, people, dope sacks. People were falling on the taxi car. I seen punk rockers and young people pushing baskets. There was a Triple X shop across the street, and people were in and out of there, you know, curtains going there, and then there was a chicken place coming, and I seen what I thought was, not vampires, but I thought they were vampires, but, you know, that one culture, the subculture, the children when they're goth. There were just everything here, punk rockers, goth, there were rockers, there were, you know, every cultural you could imagine, you know, Koreans here, Japanese over here, people pushing baskets, murders going on here. And it looked like a candlelit vigil from about Spring Street to where that theater is across the street. And it was next door to the Triple X theater.
Okay. Well, look, now what do you think about the cultural life of the Skid Row community now? What's happening down there now? Can you comment on that?
Well, one thing about here, this area, Los Angeles, and one thing I think about the people on Skid Row, this has always been claimed as an arts district. And at one time, it was really popping with artists down here from every genre, from graphic artists, you know, musicians or whatever you considered art, poetry, spoken word. And one thing I think about Skid Row, that's where a lot of people in the arts or entertainment has gravitated to. Maybe some people come off the bus and say, I have a dream and I want to be an artist or an actress and things of that thing. But they've kept that culture alive. It's just that the reason they gravitated to Skid Row, but that's probably where they were given social services and stuff. But you go down to Skid Row, you'll see a full line, a full genre of talent. But I believe that has been exploited to a certain point, yeah.
Are there many programs for children, culture life for children in the Skid Row area?
Not many. Mm-hmm. Not many at all. I don't know. I think OG tried to do something at one time. I'm not sure if Qumran has tried to address the issue and LAPD. Not meaning at all. They have one at the church, the outreach church, the Church of Nazarene. It does assist the children in the neighborhood to help them with the arts on Fridays. There was a couple of artists that came out and given out their time on Fridays. We used to do that for a while. But nothing to actually address the issues. I remember Agape Church, Ricky Byers Beckwith, did come out one time and assist some of the children here with her program. Yeah, Kumba, Creative Arts for Children who were not afforded to get the type of cultural upbringing they could possibly get, but she would afford it to them free at no cost.
Okay. You were in the daytime soap box. The Bold and the Beautiful. Yeah, can you tell, how did that come about and what was that like?
Wow. Okay, well, it was a blessing, I guess. That particular day, I was feeling like doing away with myself because I've been down here so long. I've been down here since, 1999. No, yeah, you know. I didn't think I was going to get off of it. And I came down to do an extra part, but they wanted to know a little bit of my story. And I hadn't told anyone my story. I guess a few people knew about it, but just kind of kept it under wraps. And I did. At that time, I told my told a bit of my story about what I went through when I did come down here on Skid Row. I ended up getting locked up in a closet that same night that I went through this, coming to see this place. You know, 4 hours later, I was put in a closet.
Oh, my God.
Wasn't able to come out for almost a year. I thought it was 6 weeks, but my friend told me it was nearly a year. But, and I told them now they were getting interviews from us, you know. And it just so happened, they called me back to do an audition. I never had an audition before. And I passed audition by the grace of God. So Skid Row experience is not that bad. One of the women did tell me on the show, one thing they've always reminded me at the Bold and Beautiful and the Bell family, everyone there has reminded me not to be so begrudging about living here because, you know, it may not be what I thought because I came here from Hawaii, 4 bedrooms in here, you know, and I was able to survive. California, I mean, I had things in Hawaii, you know, the populace of making money there. It's like our houses were like $300,000. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how I saved in Hawaii, but it's hard to save here in California, you know what I mean? But she said not to feel so bad about it, you know, going through those issues. Because if I hadn't been through Skid Row, when I went through on Skid Row, they wouldn't have never found me.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this. What do you think was the impact of the Bold and the Beautiful working in a Skid Row storyline?
Well, you know, it brought enlightenment to the homeless issue. And then it also afforded them to not just come out with a storyline and get out here and do a job and go, because they actually got to meet us as a community, we have a subculture down here, you know, it's a whole different way of living. And not everybody down here is on drugs or alcohol or is ready to pimp you or, you know, hustle you per se. We do have a unity here. We might tell each other off, but we got each other. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? You know.
Now, what was the biggest? What were their reaction to some of these actors and actresses who have never been to the Skid Row area?
Well, I think seeing people who just looking at people just as yourself, you know, this situation, homelessness, veterans down here, there are over 9,000 veterans. That's a sad thing that has been displaced here. And most of them live here in Skid Row. Mm-hmm. And to see people who've worked for this country, who've laid down their lives for this country, to see mothers and fathers and children mm-hmm. in this situation, this could be you. I mean, paycheck to paycheck. It brought enlightenment to say, you know, these are regular people, you know, who may not be hard on their luck, or some of them is like, hey, look, this is what I've been given. This is the card I've been dealt, the hand I've been dealt in this card game, and I'm finna dish it out. Nothing's finna hold me back. Cancer's not finna hold me back. Not having a house is not gonna hold me back. So what I think the Bold and Beautiful coming down here was just saying, these are regular people who are just thriving. This is a thriving community, not a surviving community, because when you're surviving, you're at the lower nature. You're really at an animalistic nature, so it's like kill to be killed. We see people who are actually viable, thriving souls and have a spirit. So that mm-hmm. brought them, that made us seem more human, I should yeah. say.
Mm-hmm. Now, didn't it Bold and Beautiful win a number of awards and stuff
oh,
like
yeah.
that?
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. They won some Emmys for coming down here and filming here on Skid Row. However, they didn't depict us as like actors. These are regular people. These are regular people's lives. And I think it's just great that they've given myself and Tony and others here an opportunity to express ourselves in a way and probably grow culturally like this and create, you know, this mm-hmm. platform for us. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this. You are a mother,
also, because I met your talented children, especially your oldest son.
Oh,
now, what is the biggest challenge trying to raise a son or daughter, not only in Skid Row, mm-hmm. but the community as a whole?
Well, Skid Row has its challenges for its socioeconomic deprivation and then the housing. There's no family housing here. So when you faced with the dilemma I was faced with, you have to make a choice, and it's a terrible choice because you separate from your children just to live. And at that time, I was under that, what I call that surviving mentality, because you don't have nowhere for your children to go, and you have to fend for them. And there's so much going on that you don't want them to visibly see or even become a part of. So that's one thing to separate that way. And then the world at large is we're losing what I call, most people are into the statusitis right now, and it's not about getting with the real and knowing the person, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know.
Do you think it's best for children to see, like communities like the Skid Row community, to bring them around to reality, the real situations?
I think so. With a tour, you know. I mean, there are people who live in Hollywood or five blocks from here, or we have people here in City Hall that don't even come down here and check out Tent City. I'm just saying it's very important to let people know it's not because this person's a derelict, you know, that they come down here, but you can end up in a situation like this in life. But, you know, and no one's better than anyone, so it's good to come out and, you know, show children what to do. I just seen a gentleman bring out his two sons, and he brought some blankets and brought some mm-hmm. food for the people to eat and left a number. Mm-hmm. And he had his own children pass those things out. Now, if you're, you know, and then, you know, it might help to scare a few of them straight, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
I tell you what, at this time, let's take a break for our community calendar, and then we will be joined by some of the cast of Surviving the Nickel and have them chime in about the culture life of the Skid Row community.
This is the community calendar for the month of October. Every Tuesday from 5:30 to 8 p.m., the Veterans Community Theater Workshop is open, and it's also for veterans and non-veterans alike. The location is the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard, that's here in Los Angeles, and it's near the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic. The Metro bus number 60 and 66 stops right at or near the corner. And if you're interested in the workshop, the contact information number is 323-850-4436. Sunday, October the 14th at 3 p.m., the Veterans Community Theater Workshop will be doing a performance of a stage play, Surviving the Nickel. This play is written and directed by Melvin Ishmael Johnson. The location of the event will be The Exchange, 114 West 5th Street, Los Angeles. And this is a free event. All are welcome to attend. Following the performance, there will be a question and answer session with a mixer, and light refreshments will be served. For more information on this event, you can call 323-850-4436. On Saturday and Sunday, October the 20th and the 21st, this is a two-day event. It's the third annual festival for all the Skid Row artists. And this event will be, once again, Saturday and Sunday, October 20th and the 21st, from 12 noon to 4 p.m. The location is at Gladys Park. It's a free event, and it's organized by LAPD, USEP, LAMP Community, and the Fine Arts Program. The event is looking for participants that do spoken word, rappers, singers, vocalists, poets, theatrical performance, music of all kind, and much, much more. They're asking you to come out and showcase your talent for the Skid Row Artist Area. And you can contact for more information, LAPD 213-413-1077. And also, D-Link elections are coming up. That's the Downtown Los Angeles Neighborhood Council. The election will be on November the 15th. And if you want to file for a candidate or a seat on the council, The deadline is October the 16th. Also, upcoming event or guests on the Qumran Report, Monday, October the 15th, we're going to have Russell Brown. He's the former president of the Downtown Los Angeles Neighborhood Council. Also, John Malpete and Arietta Bowers from the LAPD, and that's the Los Angeles Poverty Department, which is a theater company. And they will be our guests on Monday, October the 15th. And if you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, just send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Earlene Anthony. And a reminder that the call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Earlene Anthony. We're back with our guest, Leilani Sashe, and we will be joined by three members of the cast of Surviving the Nickel, which will be performed at the Exchange this Sunday, October the 14th, 2012, at 4 o'clock p.m. We also have with us in the studio Lee Shaw, Andrea Ross, and my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Let's open up the discussion to a roundtable discussion on the culture life of the Skid Row community and your role in Surviving the Nickel. Let's start with Andrea. Andrea, what are your thoughts about your role and the audience response to the play?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for letting me be a part of your play, and I was quite honored and well-received by the audience. My role as Gloria Jackson is a person who has been re-edified her life and has come from Skid Row and starting to do a better job with her life, and she still maintains friendships with those that are still living in the Skid Row area. And it was well received by the audience. I got a couple of ovations as we were performing, and I was quite honored to be a part of the cast.
Okay. Let's move on to Lee. Same question. What are your thoughts about your role? Can you tell us a little about your role and the audience response to the play?
Yeah. Play a role of Tyrone, Tyrone Washington. He's a flamboyant drug dealer, entrepreneur, you know, and he has a friend that just left out of prison and arrived on Skid Row. And he's actually trying to feel him out to see where his mind is at. You know, do he want to raise himself up, or do he just want to lay down, you know, stop right here on Skid Row? You know, and he finds himself raising his own self up to give up the game of dope and this type of thing at the same time right along with his friend. So he's an exceptional character. Mm-hmm. I enjoy playing him. So, mm-hmm.
You know. What was your approach to learning this particular character, T. Ronnie?
Well, I have a strange way of trying to remember things. So I had to kind of, what kind of person, you know, how do we move, you know? How do we speak? You know, he's real, you know, some guys are real meticulous. Everything got to be just right, you know. So I kind of took that approach, and to learn the role, to learn the language, the words, I would get up early in the morning where it's nice and peaceful. And most of the time, I would leave L.A. and go out to my brother's house, mm-hmm. stay a few days out there because I can, it's no noise. It's not even a helicopter flying in the air. No ambulances, no police, none of that, right? So I would get up. 5:30, had me a cup of coffee, go out on the patio with me and this little dog, Shadow, and we would just walk back and forth, and I would go through the lines, for 2 hours. And before I would go to sleep at night, I would go through them again. And the first thing in the morning, after thanking God that I woke up, I would go through them before I raise up out of the bed. Mm-hmm. And then I repeat this thing.
And work on
it. And I learned the whole T-Roney script, his dialogue. Mm-hmm. Within 2 days, mm-hmm. I just worked on the preparations as far as delivery, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay. We're going to come back around there. Ms. Earlene Anthony, questions. What's your thoughts on your role and the audience response to the role? Tell us about the role you play.
I played Anita Sampson. She's the parole officer. Anita Sampson, she's a parole officer that has probably heard all the excuses that there are, and she's kind of burnt out, and she's the 9-to-5 parole officer, and it's like she want to just get in her time during the day, get the parolees in there and talk to them and, you know, just get them out and for her to get on home and, you know, leave the whole thing behind. But when she deal with Malik Morrison, he's the parolee that's, you know, come in and talking to her. She really, you know, think he's going to make it, and she's really pulling for him. But she has to go about it in a way that she can't treat him any different than anybody else. She has to be tough on him because she believes if she's really tough and let up on him, he's going to get tired of playing the same old role and doing the same old thing, you know, the excuses and all that. And he's going to make this change and turn his life around. This is what she's hoping for.
Mm-hmm.
And playing Anita Sampson, I love the role. It gave me a chance to be a whole different person that opposite my personality. And I believe it was well received. And also, as far as learning my lines, I only learn my lines or study my lines when I'm at a rehearsal or if I'm going someplace on the bus. This is how I learn my lines. I don't usually study them at home or whatever. Once in a while, the director will say, let's rehearse. But usually it's on the bus or at rehearsal or when the director say, okay, let's see where you are with the script.
Okay.
Know that feeling quite
yes.
well.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's throw this out for a discussion. What are your thoughts on the relationship of domestic violence and so many women's ending up on Skid Row? This is a roundtable discussion, so you want to pick up on that?
Well, one of the reasons I didn't mention, but I had been involved, you know, a victim. I hate to say the word victim because I'm not a victim anymore. I'm a victor of domestic violence. And that's one of the reasons that brought me down here. But I thought the domestic violence I went through with my husband was candy compared to what I went through when I came down here. Didn't think I was going to survive it, but I did. And I think that's why a lot of the trajectory of women and children changed, I believe, in 2003. There was an influx of women and children that came down here. And we did a survey, and it was because of the domestic violence and being displaced. Women have been with this issue for a long time, and so have men. I started an organization to address those issues in men and women. And that's one of the reasons people are here. A lot of men don't want to talk about it, but you can actually become, you know, the victimizer yourself after going through so much abuse, living down here on Skid Row in a war zone. You, as a woman, you might become a victimizer yourself mm-hmm. because you have to put on so much of a, I don't know if you say what, your armor, and mm-hmm. you become numb. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think out of that was birthing in me this creativity, mm-hmm. you know, poetry, spoken word, and also the various characters that I've came to mm-hmm. come in contact with in myself. You know, they said it was multiple personality disorder, but I've used it as a cathartic. But I'm so sure Andrea knows what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Without
Andrea.
A doubt.
Okay.
I can definitely attest to your testimony. I, too, was a victim of domestic violence for many, many years. And in order to just have self-autonomy over myself, I've chose just to walk away from a very rich life, materialistically rich, mm-hmm. but spiritually poor. I left mm-hmm. the job that I was on 17 years at the United States Postal Service. Homes, clothes, mm-hmm. cars, trucks, you name it, I had it. But the only thing that I did not have was happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like although I lost all the material trappings, I became so much more rich in my spirit and my soul. And self-autonomy is priceless. There is not a price that you can put on the ability to be in charge of your own destiny.
Yes.
And once you have just a little taste of it, you just thirst for it. And it just took a drastic change in my life. And I'm talking about just walking away with a purse and what was on my back in 2006. Now, flash forward to 2012. I'm in this wonderful theater group. I'm just in the midst of making a movie called Just Like Compton. It'll be out next year. I've written 6 children's books. I've illustrated 4 of the 6. I'm doing poetry all over town. And I'm what's known as a local celebrity. And I'm quite happy about that. So God be the glory.
Let me ask you this. The domestic violence thing, is that a slow process? Is it something that the partner recognized at the beginning, or is it a misconception, or is it something that builds up over a slow period of time? What are your thoughts on that?
It rears its ugly head once you're in a relationship. Now, you don't come into the relationship with knowing that this person is like this, because that's not going to get you close to this person. So what they do, they reel you in with such kindness and, oh, they're just so wonderful. And then 2 or 3 years into the relationship, it's just like night and day. And they become controlling, manipulative. You say jump, I say how high, that type of mentality. It's you suffer in silence and shame. You don't want to reach out because your family, your shame, your friends, you know, how are you going to let someone treat you like this? So you suffer in silence. Yeah. I find that many domestic violent situations are suffering in silence. They don't want anyone to know.
Do you think it starts off with verbal abuse first and then moves into physical abuse, or what?
It starts with the verbal abuse, but can I just say, sometimes the verbal abuse is worse than the physical abuse, because physically the scars will go away. But mentally, unless you get help or therapy, you always suffer what self-esteem issues, you know. Well, why am I being treated like this? And why can't I get out? It's so many whys and no answers. But I do say that we do need more social services for women that and men too that suffer in domestic violence, and of course for the children.
Mm-hmm.
There is, to me, no pattern, because when you were asking this question, all the above, because it's a predatory type thing.
Mm-hmm.
People observe you and watch your ways and find out how to get inside your head. That's, what I call the pimp mentality or whatever.
Let me ask you this, because I used to think that it had a lot to do with economic situation until... recently, when we was talking about some of the young entertainers that that got caught up, I think we discussed one of them. Was it Chris Brown
that
we was talking about? Yeah, who we know is financially well off. What do you think? How did domestic violence enter into a situation like that when you have so much financial resources and everything a person wants?
Because, it's like any disease, you know, alcoholism or whatever. It's a disease. You're without ease. It's a lack of peace, you know. And then most of the abusers are insecure, you know. So there's, you know, rage is intermittent fits of, that's what you call insecurity. It's intermittent fits of rage. And so you don't know when it's coming. You don't know what's going to be said. You don't even know the person's actions. There's so many ways to abuse a person. You can just silently abuse a person, you know what I mean? Not recognize that they're not there. You can say your demeanor may be wrong, you know. Well, good morning, that sarcasm, that sinisterism, or having that jealousy, you know, like I said, an intermittent fist of rage. So, you know, and then after you've, like, one thing Andrea touched on was the low self-esteem, the low self, and the low value, having low self-worth, or always trying to be a people pleaser. You exactly. Forget who you are.
Forgot yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You forget about yourself.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Lee, you want to say something on that?
Yeah, I think, it's, I was listening to what the ladies had to say, and I've said this before. People are not trained. Mm-hmm. Men are reasonable. They're rational. We're thinking we'll go along with things. This is not taught to the younger people. Why it's not taught? Because most parents are single parents. Mm. And we know sometimes women can't take a whole lot of pressure like a man can, right? So what happens? When mom gets, now I'm not saying this is every woman, because there's some women can raise men and real well. Mm-hmm. But just the majority of them get themselves stuck in these situations. They try to discipline their children, and they keep, be quiet, boy. And he keeps on going. And then what happens after he keeps on going, you know, she lashes out at it, right? He learns this behavior because he has no man around him to teach him, right? So when he's had enough, right, well, when she's had enough, she whoops him, right? And as he grows, right, there's no man around to, hey, just listen, boy. You know how to listen. It's an art of listening. He grows up with the same mentality. When I had enough, I'm going to lash out at you. I'm going to give you the right hand, the uppercut. You know what I'm saying? So we got to go. We need to go back a little further than just that particular person, because even in a household where there was a mother and a father, mm-hmm. the father didn't get this information, right? So the son follows in his footsteps. If he beat up mom, I'm going to beat my girl. That's what we're supposed to do it. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So we need to go back mm-hmm. and understand that men reasonable and rational. Get to the center of the table. We're going to talk about this, right? We ain't got to lift our hands, mm-hmm. right? But these people today, they have no clue as to why they act the way they act. Mm-hmm. Especially young brothers today. They are getting into more domestic violence situations than history, man.
And at a younger age.
Yeah,
teenagers, too. That's what we're younger having age. Now. We're having mm-hmm. now... domestic violence, you know, we're going around the schools now because it's predominantly, now we had it in the lesbian and gay and transgender community the last 2 years. And now we're having it with our teenagers and college students. Yeah. And it's so silent. The girls are ending up dead.
Yeah. That's what coming up missing. Silence. I mean, you know.
It's verbally abusive first.
A few cases where, I mean, hey, I'm in college. I'm finna graduate. I'm finna get my master's degree. I'm finna go on and do the things I want to do. I got a girlfriend that I love so very much, and she can say something that sends me into it. And it's little simple things, mm-hmm. you know, that you can sit on the table with, or just let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. Not right now. Let's go to dinner right now, and we'll talk about it later, right? To give them
okay.
time. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
But what they do, they lash out. You know, they do the, you know, it just comes like pop, just like that.
Okay, let's move on to another subject that I want to talk about. Can you comment? I want to get you a comment. Let's talk about the Skid Row community and the police. Mm-hmm. Because there's always seemed to be an adversary type of relationship, you know, that creates a lot of tension. So can you get some thoughts on the Skid Row community and the police?
Well, I'm friends with Officer Joseph and a whole lot of officers in the Skid Row community. However, back in the day, I probably wasn't. It's because, you know, you have a person of authority there, and you're not sure if this person's on your side, you know what I'm saying? And then getting locked up and put in the back of a car like an animal and not given the rights. You know, Skid Row had his own little rules, you know, down here. A lot of times your Miranda rights wasn't read. We've seen, you know, horses kind of, you know, hurt people. Instead, you use animals as, you know, dehumanizing animals. They weren't doing animals right. So, you know, you have to come, when you come into your senses like I've done now, and realize those are just independent or just isolated incidents. Then you get to see people as a whole and see who's actually working here and who's not posing a threat. Now, they have brought out a lot of police in the last, and I think LAPD did something about that, AB 34, how they sent all these police out here, and we were trying to figure out, what was this, a training ground? What's mm-hmm. happening down here, you know? And I felt like it was a city under siege. Mm-hmm. We didn't need that many police. So when you do that and you're in a place where people are already deprived of just the basic needs and necessities of life, and one just being saying, hi, how you doing, instead of just walking past me, mm-hmm. you know. And, yeah, at one time Skid Row, when I first came down here, it was crime-ridden. We were having 30 crimes almost a day.
Yeah.
Now it's down to maybe 15 a month. You know, we were having murders that were actually taken down.
Okay. So, Andrea.
Well, I feel like the police at large, they need to have more hands-on involvement with the people, and not as a criminal element, but just as a person. You know, if you could have some programs that are sponsored by the Los Angeles Police Department for the people, the community of Skid Row, for the children, you know, take them to the station, show them the positive aspects that the police community is supposed to, you know, compassion.
You think that would improve the relationship?
I think that would improve the relationship tremendously. When you don't just see me as a criminal, but as a human being with problems that you may be able to alleviate just with a kind word,
mm-hmm.
and not a baton,
mm-hmm.
or handcuffs in a car.
Okay. Lee.
I want to take you back a little piece. In the 1960s, Central Avenue, Vernon, 54th Street, right? The police used to walk the beat. I mean, every day, it was up and down, walking. So they got a chance to meet the people,
yes.
in that particular community, right? Then in that, mm-hmm. area, right? And in even then, they would, if they seen somebody's kid doing something wrong, mm-hmm. they wasn't gaffing him up, putting him in the thing. Check this out. You need to get your butt in the schoolhouse, and quickly. And if I see you out here again, I'm going to tell your mother,
yeah,
or your father.
They mother.
And they know when you get home. See, because they knew him. See, they had interacted with these people. The whole thing was to get to know the people in that particular area and work with them. Downtown, you say job security, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that struck me real, and I can't remember exactly the date. I just say it was, when did Bill Gates retire? Leave the police department.
Daryl Gates.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking riches. See what my mind is at. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Somewhere.
It was over 10, right after the Rodney King incident.
Right after
the
riot.
That was 92.
Okay.
So around 10 years
ago. Well, anyway, I think it was Bill Gates and Sheriff Lee Baca. Now, can anybody at this table tell me, what is these two gentlemen, one running the sheriff's department, one running the LAPD, doing in Israel? Oh, did you go over there to pray? Doubtful. No, you went there to find out how the Israelis were treating the Palestinians, how you round them up and so they could bring the same mentality back to the ghetto, mm-hmm. back to South Central, the same mentality. I say, I'm the one, I like to go back. See, because going back, I can see the problem as it was moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say, what were they doing in Israel?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, Erling, you want to comment on the relationship between the police and the Skid Row?
When I was down on Skid Row, and I was there for a lot of years, like a few other people, I really didn't see a lot of, interaction with the police or the people. I just heard a lot of stories about what was happening there. I didn't actually see, you know, a policeman come up and arrest anybody or harass anybody or whatever. I just heard people, you know, or new people that would tell what had happened to them by the police department.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I was always brought up to respect the police or respect the law. Mm-hmm. And I thank God, have never really had any adverse contact or whatever, coming in contact with a policeman or police people or law people.
Okay.
But on Skid Row, just a lot of people come and telling me how they have been dealt with by the police.
Mm-hmm. You know, you got good and bad people wherever you at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether you're citizen, the police, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of times people play as a team. Those who are good usually don't last too long. If you ain't on a team with the right, you know, get together with the right ones. Let's do this by the book. We have some rules to go by as well as everybody else. And a lot of times, police or people, DAs or whoever it is, they don't go by the rules. They make their own rules up.
That's right.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And no one
because
to answer to. Mm-hmm.
It's been in many cases they done come up. The guy here not too recently spent 20 years of his life in a prison that he already told him, I'm at grandma's house. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But now, you... sometimes the DA even knows to say, but you know what? But you know what the killer is? My career. Mm-hmm. My career is before justice.
Okay. Look, let me roll us a couple more things I wanted to talk about, and then we want to get into some poems and a couple songs that we want to do. But I want to talk about a couple more things. I want to talk about the community leadership in Skid Row. How can we improve those who emerges as the leaders in Skid Row, representing the community? Let's start off with Sashe and move on down the line.
Well, it's been said, it's a known, like we're having here a roundtable discussion. I think all leaders, if you're going to be voted on or whatever, you make yourself a leader, you need to be involved with the community at large. You mm-hmm. really do. You need to, be able to walk the streets, be with the people, find out what the opinions are, find out what's going on, find out, like the Ellis Hotel has predominantly elderly people there. How do we make sure that they're being checked on, things of that nature? See who actually needs water. Find out what's really going on in a community, because you can't, you can't help a community unless you know the community. And we know you by face. And a lot of times we come here with these positions, and you're not planning on getting to know anyone, or if you just down here for your job, at least take a training on how to deal with difficult people mm-hmm. and allow us as a community to make you accountable for that.
Okay, yes. Accountability. Yeah.
And I'll just coattail on that. I think unless you walk a mile in a man's shoes, then you really don't know what that person is going through. And in order to know what that person is going through, you got to get down in the trenches and be about how they are living. Mm-hmm. What do they need? Ask the question. If you ask the question, you undoubtedly will get several answers, and that's what you draw from. You draw from the community at large. Ask them the questions and see what the response is, and that's how you get to know the community.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Lee, how can we hold these community leaders more accountable?
Go to the box. You know what I'm saying? I believe in it. If I vote, if I can vote you in, I can vote you out of there.
That's it.
You know what I'm saying? You won't get a chance to twist me twice.
That's
you know what I'm saying? Then you
that's
won't.
It.
You know what I'm saying? Because what most people, what a lot of these people do, they start off with a genuine, thing to help people, to help mm-hmm. the people, right? Mm-hmm. Once they get in there, they become like those who all been sitting there so long, now it's about me. When you are public, when you dealing with speaking for the public, mm-hmm. one thing I learned from Martin Luther King, you have to forget about yourself with certain things. Because mm-hmm. you're dealing for the people now. Mm-hmm. Not dealing for me no more. If I just wanted to deal for me, I just go get me a 9-to-5 and say everybody else. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? But now you're dealing with you're talking for all the people. So you got to give up something yourself. If I'm for the people,
sacrifice.
I make the sacrifice for myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to go into another subject where we roll down, and then we're going to get into some cultural arts poems. The military veterans. Let's talk about what's happening. How come so many homeless military veterans who have served that? I'm a veteran also, and I see all of these homeless veterans down here. Anybody want a quick comment on that?
Yeah.
They said it's over 9,000 here, and this is a place that has services, and a lot of people just don't recognize, and I don't know what's wrong with America. There's no way I'm going to, not recognize. You don't went out here and fought for this company, and you're coming back with, you have infractions, you got no hands.
Post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Issues that are not being addressed, and the VOA said they don't have the money to address these issues, and to have a service member, I was married to one, to come back and be homeless?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
And that's one of the things that we wanted to deal with it in the play, because Malik Morrison is a veteran hitting in that. Okay, look, let me, Andrea, why don't you, right now, I would like to have you do a poem for us. What's the name of the poem you're going to do?
It's called A Smile is a Sandwich.
Yeah.
And it speaks to the mentality that a lot of people deal with homelessness and homeless people. And okay. If you see yourself on any one of these pages, then you know that this poem was meant for you. And this is entitled A Smile is a Sandwich.
All right.
Do you have any extra change, miss? A quarter, nickel, dime, a penny? No, no, I do not, sir. I do not have any. Well, do you have a pair of shoes, miss? My feet are cold, frostbitten, and bare. No, no, I do not, sir, at least not that I can spare. Well, do you have a coat or a blanket, miss? It's oh so very cold out here at night. No, no, I do not, sir, and besides, that's not my problem nor my plight. Well, do you have just a minute, miss, to listen to my humble cry? No, 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 and do not ask me why. Well, do you have a smile, miss? Because a smile is a sandwich. A smile takes away hunger. It alleviates pain. It ends this curse of anonymity, this senselessness now made sane. A smile, too, save me from the abyss of nothingness. To see me as a human, no more and no less. And know that I, too, have true feelings and I'm not just a tattered, shabby old mess. You see, hard times laden me daily like a weight, an albatross around my neck. But that does not give you the right to treat me ill-tempered with no respect. For I am somebody also, although thankfully I'm not like you. I'm just God's child living in this devilish hell. But good day, miss. God bless you anyway, and I still do wish you well. So just smile, miss, because your smile is my sandwich. Thank you.
Okay, look, let me get about 30 seconds, quickly closing comments, and then we'll have Sashe hit us with a song as we wind out. Start with about Lee, about 30 seconds, closing comments.
Well, you know, downtown, beautiful place. You know what I'm saying? Could be more beautiful. I just can't understand why people turn a blind eye, you know, mm-hmm. to downtown. I live right across the street from you, but the streets are separating me and you. Monetary things separates me and you. But we both human beings. We do basically the same thing. We need the same things. So, you know, people need to start caring about other people, man. Okay. That's the thing.
Earlene.
A reminder to come to the show Sunday, October the 14th, Surviving the Nickel. There is something that everybody that can relate to that's in that play. Thank right. you.
Andrea.
Yes, well, I guess I summed it up best by that last poem that I brought to the public. And if you see yourself treating people in this way, just take a step back and realize this could be you. Life spins on a dime. And tomorrow, this could be you with your hand out. So if mm-hmm. you got a hand out, help somebody up.
Okay, got a short caller on the line. Who am I speaking with?
This is Mr. James Gordon.
Okay, Mr. James, yeah.
I'm late watching, listening to the show and everything, but I'm kind of late. But I'll say this to everybody. Nicholas, beautiful. Miss D, we're trying to put the music for your nickel play, if we can. That's what a surprise I was going to get to you. But on Skid Row, my quickie is right there is let the veterans do something to help the people, the knowledge that they have. Let them help the people. We don't need them out there. They got too much knowledge.
Okay.
Everybody just to keep throwing away.
Okay, James. Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Gordley, yeah, Mr. Vice
thank
President.
Thank you for calling in.
From Modesto, California.
Thank you.
I'll see you soon, everybody.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to have you in the studio again.
Hello.
Okay.
Oh, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Simplify.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes. And thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. You can check out our shows on www.qumran.org, skidrow.la. And at this time, I'm going to move over to Sashe. She's going to sing the song Strange Fruits that we close out. Sashe.
Strange fruit hanging from a tree. Strange fruit looks like you, looks like me. Strange trees walking around with no roots in the ground. These trees are bodies walking around Skid Row downtown. Strange fruit hanging from a tree. Tree looks like you, looks like me. See, I'm a product of my society. I had plans to make a deal, maybe a book, a movie, or record deal. But now I'm trying to find my last meal. I'm strange fruit, strange fruit.
Thank you, Leilani Sashe.
Great show. I think we got everything.
Yeah.